I circled the town of Winslow and mapped a route from my house to a promising-looking restaurant in the town center. What harm would it do if I drove out there for lunch? It was going to be a beautiful October day. After a hot, extended summer, the leaves were just now at their peak. I could take a walk, eat some lunch, see the town that Lily lived in. And if I saw her, and the chances of that were slim, then what would the harm be? We wouldn't need to say hello, and if we did, would it possibly make a difference? I did my work, then showered and dressed. In my garage, I decided, on the spur of the moment, to take out my vintage 1976 Porsche 911, the car I'd bought after I'd made my first big deal, instead of the Audi. I avoided the pike and drove toward the river, getting onto Starro Drive. The river was filled with college rowers, prepping for the upcoming Head of the Charles weekend. The day was perfection, the sky only creased by the vapor trails of airplanes. I looked up, wondering if I was seeing the remnants of the plane that was taking my wife to Florida. From Starro Drive, I got onto Soldiers Field Road, then wound my way through Waltham and Newton Hill till I found Boston Post Road, and headed west through the suburbs toward Winslow. Shifting gears, I wondered why I'd ever gotten the automatic transmission on my Audi. The next car I bought would be a standard. I drove down Main Street in Winslow Center, looking for parking in the surprisingly busy downtown. Students were crossing the street in large groups, mostly girls in jeans and boots, with hair pulled back in ponytails. Waiting for several to cross the walkway, I peered through the abutting metal gates toward the college campus. I could see three low brick buildings that bordered a carefully manicured lawn. A line of oaks marked a path across the campus. Was Lily in one of the buildings I could see? Was she the type who brought a sensible lunch and ate in her office, or did she walk into the town center for lunch? It was a Friday, after all. A sunny October day. The car behind me honked, and I put the Porsche in gear, then turned off Main onto a side street with metered parking. I found a spot, and walked back toward the group of restaurants I'd passed earlier. The place I'd read about, the Carvery, was there, but I chose a restaurant called Allison's that had an open outside table that faced both the high midday sun and Winslow's campus. I ordered a Bloody Mary and a Cobb salad from the college student waitress, and watched the pedestrians pass by. The students had the scrub-faced look of earnest young feminists. They hauled backpacks that looked as though they'd put a football player into traction. The non-students were mostly middle-aged housewives out for shopping and lunch. They wore handmade scarves and flouncy clothes that hid their hips. I saw a few professor types, men with bad haircuts and tweedy jackets, and women who looked like older versions of the solemn young students. But I didn't see Lily. Even when after lunch and a second Bloody Mary, I took a walk through Winslow's campus. It was a pretty college, its campus gently sloping away from Winslow's center down toward a pond that was circled with a walking path. I sat for a while on a wooden bench in the botanic gardens, next to a conservatory with a high-peaked roof. There was no one around, and I imagined that this might be the type of place where Lily would bring her lunch. To this very bench, maybe. I stayed seated until clouds appeared in the sky, and the sun disappeared, and suddenly it was cold. I'd forgotten to refeed the parking meter after lunch, and I had a Town of Winslow parking violation under my wiper. $15. I slid it into my jacket pocket and lowered myself into the Porsche. I was tired all of a sudden, and took the pike all the way back to Boston, arriving at home just as I received a text from Miranda that she had safely landed in Miami, and the festivities had begun. I texted her back, then went to my computer to check my emails. It was a slow period for me, not that I needed the work. The stock market, after years of stagnation, was surging again. My portfolio was healthy, and work was just a matter of filling my time. Another text from Miranda. Don't forget to take the lamb out of the freezer. I wrote back, thanking her for the reminder. I had actually forgotten, and walked down to the basement kitchen, taking the loin chops out of the freezer and putting them under running water. The text from Miranda was strange, as was the overly sentimental goodbye. Was she up to something sinister? Or was it possible that she had broken it off with Brad, and was suddenly contrite? Even so, that didn't take away from what she had already done to me. I went into the adjoining wine cellar and picked an old-world Syrah that would go nicely with the lamb. I opened the bottle and decanted it. The chops were starting to soften, so I left them in their plastic wrap in a bowl of cold water, and went upstairs to the living room. I hadn't seen the paper yet that day, so I sat in the leather recliner and read the day's news while sipping a gin and tonic. After a while, I put the paper down and just thought about Miranda and Brad and Lily and everything that had happened, or that was about to happen, since meeting Lily on the plane from London. I kept involuntarily flashing back to the dream I had awoken from that morning, that awful feeling that once you've murdered someone, you can never go back and unmurder them. You will never again awake from a dream and be able to lie there, telling yourself that your life may be a catalogue of sin, but that you are not a murderer. And I suddenly realized that my plan to kill Miranda and Brad had become a means to an end, had become a way to get closer to Lily, and that I didn't necessarily need to commit murder to get there. I could simply tell Miranda I wanted a divorce, then email Lily and ask her if she were free for dinner. No one but us would ever know about the plans we had made. Miranda could have Brad and I'd have Lily and the world would keep on spinning. I'd always been good at compartmentalizing, and I would put all my rage and shame over what had happened with Miranda into a box and close it. I would hand my marriage to the lawyers. Half of all my money was more than enough. A feeling of relief swept through me. It was like waking from a bad dream and realizing that it was just a dream, that it hadn't actually happened. The doorbell chimed and I jumped a little in my chair. Walking to the door, I instinctively looked at my watch. It was just past 6. Who would be stopping by? I told myself it was probably a delivery man and tried to remember if I was waiting for a package. I put the chain across the door and swung it open 5 inches. It was Brad Daggett, a slightly embarrassed smile on his face. It took me a moment to register that Brad, from Maine, was on my doorstep in Boston. It felt incongruous, like seeing a man in a tuxedo at a country fair. "Ted," he said, and he sounded a little breathless. "I'm glad you're here. Can we talk?" "Of course," I said, undoing the chain and opening the door. "Come on in." As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I regretted them. There was no good reason for Brad to come all the way from Maine to see me. He was halfway into the house, and I pushed slightly against the door, stopping his progress. "Brad, what are you doing here?" "Just let me in, Ted. I'll explain." His voice quivered, and I could smell the booze on his breath. Our eyes met, and I was suddenly scared. I pushed a little harder against the door, but Brad wasn't moving. He fumbled in his jacket pocket, and I looked down at the gun he had removed. "Let me in, Ted," he repeated, and I stepped back as Brad entered my house.
Chapter 14. Lily. "Edison, what's the matter?" I asked.
"Fucking Nolan,"
she said, and came through the door, following me down the stairs. She was brushing rain from her coat, spatters of it striking the back of my head. "You two have a fight?" I asked, as we entered our flat. She looked at me, wiping tears off her cheeks with the palms of her hands.
"He has a girlfriend back at TCU. A serious girlfriend."
"Shit," I said. "How'd you find out?" Addison told me how she'd gone onto his computer and read his emails, and how he confessed to everything, telling her that he'd been meaning to tell her about Linda, but at first he thought that they, Addison and him, were just having a fling, and now he didn't know. I half listened, opening a bottle of wine and pouring Addison a glass, but my mind was frantically trying to figure out what to do when Eric returned. Should I abandon the whole plan, telling Eric that I was pretty sure the chicken korma had cashews in it, or should I allow it to play out, with Addison as a witness? In some ways, having Addison here might be better. She would back up my story, that a drunk Eric mistakenly ate Indian food that had cashews in it, and that we couldn't immediately find his EpiPen. But there were also so many ways that it could go wrong with Addison here. She could call for an ambulance that might get here in time. She could notice that Eric's EpiPen was not where he thought it was, and if Eric asked about the chicken korma, whether or not it had nuts in it, then I couldn't lie in front of her. And most important, it wasn't fair to Addison to let her watch Eric die from anaphylactic shock. I decided it was off.
"Wait, where's Eric? Didn't his plane make it here?"
Addison asked, her head swiveling around our small flat as though he were here and she had somehow missed him. You know that pub challenge at the bottle and glass?
The 10-pot thing?
I told her about Eric insisting he could do it, and I told her how I got hungry and sick of waiting for him, and just took off. I guess neither of us is having a good night with our man. Well, I'll live, I said. You're the one who got screwed over. What are you going to do about it? Before Addison could answer, the door buzzed again. That's Eric, I said. Prepare yourself. He's going to be smashed.
Lily, I'll just leave. I totally forgot he was coming in tonight.
Addison stood, snatching her purse from the kitchen table. Not a chance. You stay here. I climbed the stairs again, bracing myself for a drunk Eric. But when I opened the door, it wasn't Eric standing there, but Nolan, his eyes red-rimmed from crying.
Ah, the bigamist, I said, and he gave me a confused look.
Is she here?
Nolan was tall and skinny with bright red ears. His close-cropped hair was an almost white blonde, and he wore a puka necklace tight around his neck.
She's here, I said, but that doesn't mean she wants to see you.
You wait here, and I'll go check. I left Nolan on the stoop and went back downstairs. Addison was refilling her wine glass.
Guess who's here?
Who? She looked genuinely puzzled. Nolan. I left him upstairs. You want me to send him away? She let out a long, dramatic breath.
No, I'll see him.
She continued to sit there at the table, and I realized that she was expecting me to go get him. I climbed the stairs for what seemed like the 20th time that night, and when I reached the door, I could hear male voices talking loudly at one another. I recognized one as Eric. He was back from the pub.
I see you two have met, I said, opening the door to find them together.
Eric, with a hand on Nolan's shoulder, telling him about the pub challenge. I knew that Eric had succeeded by the way he turned toward me, a handsome grin on his face.
And it looks like you triumphed, I added to Eric.
Barely, he said. It's much goddamn harder than it looks.
Come down, you two.
Eric, let Nolan and my roommate be. They need to talk. We all trooped down the clattery stairs. Addison was now standing in our doorway, a look of determination on her face. Nolan said,
Ad,
in a hoarse voice. Eric introduced himself, sounding relatively normal for someone with so much beer in him. It was one of his immutable traits, that he was always civil and friendly, no matter what the circumstance. A politician, basically. Eric and I went inside while Nolan and Addison stood just outside the door on our grim landing, lit only by a bare light bulb hanging from its cord. I filled Eric in on what was going on, looking to gauge any reaction he might have to hearing that Nolan was, like himself, dating two women at the same time.
"You think they'll work it out?"
he asked, then said before I had a chance to answer,
I need to eat something.
I was about to tell him that there was Indian food in the fridge that I could heat up for him, and that he shouldn't risk the chicken korma because I thought it had nuts in it, when Addison pushed her way back into the flat.
Don't worry, you two. We're going to give you some privacy. We're going to go get a drink.
Nolan was behind her, and I could tell by the redness around both their mouths that they had been kissing in the hallway. I don't know what he had said, but it had worked. Addison grabbed her coat and purse, and they went back out into the damp night. I realized suddenly that my plan was back on, if I wanted it to be. My stomach roiled with anxiety, but if anything, what I had just witnessed between Nolan and Addison had given me added resolve. Guys like Nolan and Eric got away with breaking hearts far too often.
Look, Eric, I said,
I'm exhausted. I drank too much myself, and Addison wiped me out. I'm getting into bed. There's Indian in the fridge if you want. I got you a chicken korma.
You goddamn saint,
he said, and kissed me sloppily on the side of my mouth. I went into the bedroom, swung the door so that it was partially open, and took off my jeans and sweater, slipping into the wool pajamas that kept me warm in our cold flat. I could hear Eric rummaging around the kitchen. There was the sound of clanking dishes, then the loud hum of the dingy microwave. I could smell the korma, the tang of spice and coconut milk, as it heated up. I was sitting on the edge of my bed. I felt calm, but my mind was feverish, filled with images. I pictured Chet in the meadow at dusk, swaying above me, not knowing he was about to die. I saw Eric emerging from his office, lighting a cigarette, meeting Faith. I saw Eric the night we first made love, his dark brown eyes an inch from mine. The microwave stopped humming, and I heard Eric open and shut the door. Then it was quiet for a moment. I assumed he was rapidly eating, maybe still standing. A minute passed, and the bedroom door swung open. Eric stood there, the food container in his hand, the skin of his face already reddish, and there was a puffiness around his eyes.
"There's nuts in here,"
he said, pointing at the container. It sounded like he was speaking through a mouthful of cotton.
"You sure? Where's your EpiPen?" I said.
"Bag."
He jabbed frantically at the air with his hand, finger toward where his bag was. I pulled his bag up from where it was resting on the floor and put it on the foot of the bed. Eric put the container down on my bedroom's bureau and went quickly to the bag, shoving me out of the way. He searched through the zippered pocket where he'd left the pens, then turned toward me, panic in his eyes and the redness of his skin now rising. One hand was now scratching at his neck.
"You didn't bring them?"
I asked in a raised, panicky-sounding voice.
"Yes,"
he said, and I could barely make out the word. It sounded as though it was coming from a great distance, the shout of a man trapped far underground in a narrow, damp cave. Eric dumped the contents of his suitcase on the bed, then began rapidly searching through them. He sat down, his body held rigidly, his lips pursed as he tried to pull air into his lungs. I began to help him sort through his clothes and toiletries, but he grabbed my arm, mimed the actions of making a phone call.
"You want me to call for help?" I asked.
He nodded. The redness around his neck and throat had puffed out alarmingly, like landmasses on a topographical map. But his face stayed pale, now taking on a bluish tinge. I ran into the adjoining room, picked up the phone, and stood for a moment, just listening to what was happening in the bedroom. I heard another zipper being opened, then a soft thwumping sound. I put the receiver gently back onto its handset, slowly counted to 10, then walked to the doorway, peered toward the bed. Eric was laid out, one hand still at his neck, but he was no longer scratching at it. His hand was just lying there, still. I watched him for long enough to know that he wasn't breathing. Then, just to make sure, I waited a minute, then crossed the room and placed two fingers along his throat and felt for a pulse. There was none. I went back to the phone and dialed 999, gave my name and address, told the woman with the chirpy voice on the other end that my boyfriend was in anaphylactic shock. After making the phone call, I moved quickly. I took the few whole cashews from the paper towel in the refrigerator and put some in the chicken korma that was still in Eric's bowl, and still warm from the microwave, and some in the takeout container. Then I flushed the paper towel and washed my hands. In the bedroom, Eric hadn't moved. I slid my hand beneath the mattress and pulled out the plastic baggie with the two unused EpiPens. Eric's belongings were spread around the room. I wiped my prints off the baggie with a pair of socks, then pushed the entire thing into one of his running sneakers. It seemed like a place where someone might keep emergency medicine. Eric never would have, but he wouldn't tell anyone that. And he wouldn't tell anyone that I had said the chicken korma didn't have nuts in it. I would tell them that he was drunk, and that he must have just decided to eat the chicken anyway. And I was in the bedroom, and then we couldn't find the EpiPens. I tried to think if there was anything else I needed to do to set the scene. I thought it might look good if I pressed on Eric's chest a few times, just to make it look as though I had tried CPR. Would a coroner be able to tell that sort of thing? I was about to start when the buzzer sounded again. I ran up the stairs to let the medics in. 3 days later, after Eric's family had been notified and arrangements had been made to have the body shipped home, the constable who had arrived after the medics that Friday night came to my door to tell me that there would be no inquest. I was pleased, of course, but surprised. I had read so many English mysteries that I just assumed that any slightly unusual death would result in an inquest, one in which all the evidence would point toward an accidental and tragic death. In a small way, I was disappointed. "Okay," I said, making my face look confused. "What does that mean?"
"Just means the coroner deemed the death accidental and doesn't see the need for further review. It's the right decision, I'd say, although an official inquest might have called into question the bottle and glass and that pub challenge of theirs. I might pop over there myself and talk to them about it." The constable had kind eyes and a mustache that obscured his upper lip. Twice now I had told him all the relevant facts. How Eric was drunk, and how I had let him know about the nuts in the korma, and how he ate it anyway. And then he didn't remember where he kept his medicine.
"Thank you so much," I said.
"Yeah, I'm thinking I might go round that pub and talk to them some more," he repeated. He lingered briefly in the doorway, then turned to go. He had told me his name, but I didn't remember it. My advisor at the Fonts Institute asked me if I'd like to return to America, and I told her that I was fine staying in London. That if there was a memorial service, I would probably go back for that, but that, despite the trauma, I was happy in London and happy in the program. It was the truth. I loved my basement flat in Maida Vale, and I loved that Addison, since the incident, was almost never there. I had never thought of myself as a city person, preferring the quiet of Connecticut to the oppressive humanity of New York City, but residential London was different. There was something calming about its long rows of flats, its leafiness, its anonymous, polite bustle. The streets near where I lived were so quiet that birdsong was more common than the sound of humans. I was happy when I heard via email that the Washburns had decided on a private family funeral, and that there would be a larger memorial service planned for some time in the future. I planned on attending. For one, it would look strange if I didn't, but I also wanted to see if Faith showed up, and if she did, what her reaction to me would be. I still wondered if she had willingly conspired with Eric to cheat on me during the summer, or if she was a fellow victim of his duplicity. It was something I intended to find out. A month and a half after Eric's death, I took a different route from the tube station back to my flat and walked past the bottle and glass. It was a cold, dark evening, and the windows of the pub brimmed with soft light and the outlines of after-work drinkers. I had not been in since the day Eric died. I pushed through the doors into the crowded space, filled up with the murmur of low English voices. I ordered a pint of Guinness at the bar and took my glass over to the wall that explained the rules and regulations of the beer challenge. Nothing had changed, and I wondered if the friendly constable had ever popped around to talk with the pub owners about changing the challenge. If he had, they hadn't listened to him.
Next to the rules was a large wooden board filled with embossed nameplates, the mostly male names of those who had completed the challenge. I went to the end of the list. Eric Washburn was the second to last name. There was also a bulletin board covered with tacked-on Polaroid photographs. All the snapshots looked the same, pale, bleary-eyed men holding aloft an empty pint glass. I found Eric's picture in the upper right-hand corner. He held his head slightly back at an angle, and his eyes were bright with what I recognized as pride. He was still a little tan from the summer, and with his head cocked back, his girlish, beautiful eyelashes were even more apparent. I thought of taking the photograph for myself, but decided against it. It belonged here. A testament. Finishing my Guinness, I thought that my career as a murderer was over. Not because I had lost the stomach for it, but because there would never be the need. I would never allow anyone to get that close to me again. To hurt me in the way that Eric had. I was a grown woman now. I had survived the vulnerability of childhood and the danger of first love. There was comfort in knowing that I would never be in either of those positions again, that from now on I would be the only person responsible for my own happiness. I walked back that night to my empty flat, made myself a simple dinner, then settled into my favorite chair to read. A long, uncomplicated life stretched out before me.
Chapter 15. Ted. I backed into the foyer, my eyes on the gun in Brad's hand. "What the fuck?" I said, and glanced at his face. He didn't look well. His normally ruddy complexion gray, and his neck muscles taut. He was wearing a jean jacket with a sheepskin lining, and there was a sheen of sweat across his forehead. He seemed drunk. "Nice place you got here," he said, and the words came out in a strange rhythm, as though he'd rehearsed them. "Can I show you around, Brad? Can I get you a drink?" His brow lowered, as though my words had confused him. "Yeah. A lot nicer than my temporary little shithole, right? This is where a real man lives, right?" A memory flashed through me. The night that Brad and I were drinking. Me saying something about where Brad lived. A hateful look on his face. And suddenly I knew that Brad was here to kill me. And instead of panicking, I became calm and rational. My mind in overdrive. I knew I could talk him out of this. I knew that I was smarter than he was. "Seriously, Brad. What are you doing with that gun?" "What do you think I'm doing?" he said. And raised it. So that it was pointed at my head. Everything in the room disappeared except that gun. "Jesus, Brad, think for a moment." I stared at the gun, probably the same one I'd seen in Brad's drawer in Kennewick. A double-action revolver. I watched as Brad slid his thumb onto the hammer. Did he not know that he could just pull the trigger? I needed to make a move, either attack or run. I was less than 2 feet from him, and I found myself lunging forward. The last time I'd been in a fight, I was a third grader. And I'd lost to a kid named Bruce in the first grade. I simply shoved at Brad as hard as I could, spinning his body so that the gun pointed away from me. He flew backward, his head striking the front door with a loud crack. I thought he might have been knocked out, but he hissed out a word I didn't understand. I turned and ran toward the stairs. As I hit the first step, already thinking about the phone on the first landing, I heard the loud pop of Brad's gun and felt a slap of air at my back. As though the bullet had missed me by less than an inch. I kept bounding up the stairs. By the time I reached the top, I could hear Brad behind me, his work boots hitting the first few steps of the stairway. I reached toward the phone, sitting on an antique phone table, and stumbled, falling to the carpeted floor, knocking the phone and the table over. Something warm had spilled across my stomach, and I put my hand there. When I pulled it back, I was surprised to see blood, and for a second wondered where it was coming from. Then Brad was standing over me, the gun pointed in my direction. He was breathing heavily, a strand of saliva hanging from his lower lip. "Why?" I said, but as soon as I said it, I knew. Brad was no psychotic, deciding to kill me because I'd insulted where he lived. He was doing this because of my wife. and in a few moments it all unfolded in front of me. Miranda was using Brad to get rid of me. She wanted all the money for herself. Why hadn't I seen this before? A sharp pang of pain went through my gut and I grimaced, then almost laughed. I looked up at Brad with his stupid face and shaking gun. "Miranda would never be with you," I said. "You don't know a fucking thing. Brad, she's using you. Who do you think they're gonna suspect? She's in Florida. You two are having an affair. Everyone knows it." I saw an expression of doubt on his face and felt a sliver of hope. I held my hand against the exit wound on my stomach. The blood pulsing through my fingers was warm and thick. "You think you're such a big deal," he said. "Brad, you're an idiot." "We'll see," he said, and pulled the trigger.
Part 2. The Half-Finished House. Chapter 16. Lily. "Hello there," I said to Ted Severson. He was sitting at the bar in the business class lounge at Heathrow Airport. I had recognized him right away, but doubted he recognized me. We'd only met once, a couple of years ago, when I had run into Faith Hobart at an outdoor market in the South End. "I go by Miranda now," Faith had said to me then. "Oh, it's my actual name. Faith's my middle name. Miranda Faith." "I don't think I knew that." "So you've lost your faith." She laughed. "I guess you could say that. This is my fiancé, Ted." A handsome, somewhat stiff man turned from looking at a vintage letterpress tray and shook my hand. He had the dry, firm grasp of the professional handshaker. But after a cursory few words about how nice it was to meet me, he turned back to the stall. I told Faith slash Miranda that I was meeting someone and needed to go. Before leaving, she said in a low voice, "That was terrible about Eric. I'm sorry I didn't get in touch with you afterward, but you were in London and..." "Never mind, Faith. It's okay." I walked away. I had thought many times about what might happen if I ran into Faith again. I suppose I should call her Miranda now. How would she react to me? Had she been surprised when she found out Eric died in London while visiting me? Had she been two-timed as well? But after meeting her at the market, seeing her with her new ink-black hair and her $500 boots, and with an oblivious fiancé, and seeing the casual way she expressed concern for me, I knew. I knew that she had actively deceived me as well. When she was with Eric in New York, she knew he was still seeing me on the weekends in Shepog. Was it payback for my dating Eric in the first place? Was she just one of those women who got off on taking men away from other women? For a brief moment, there in the South End of Boston, I re-experienced that stab of pain in my chest I had felt when I knew for sure that Eric had betrayed me with Miranda, and that my life would never be the same again. I told myself not to worry about it, and I didn't particularly, but when I saw Ted Severson at the airport, Miranda and he were married now, I'd read the announcement in the Globe. I decided to talk with him. "Hello there," I said, giving him a chance to recognize me, even though I doubted that he would. He looked up, no idea who I was. He was visibly drunk, his eyes red-rimmed and his lower lip slack. He was drinking martinis. I ordered one as well, even though I hated martinis. We shared a flight back to Boston, and he told me all about his sad life, about how Miranda was cheating on him, about his feelings of rage and resignation. He told me these things because he thought he would never see me again. At another time, another place, he would never have told me what he did. He even told me how much hate he felt for his wife, and jokingly said that he wanted to kill her. I told myself not to get involved, but I knew the moment we began to talk that it was too late. Miranda had come into my orbit again, and for a reason. Maybe it was selfishness, or maybe it was justice, or maybe it was something else altogether. But over the next few weeks, I convinced Ted Severson to murder Miranda, as well as Brad Daggett, her lover. It wasn't hard. And just when the plan was set to happen, I gathered the Sunday Globe from my stoop one morning, and over coffee at my kitchen table, I saw a picture of Ted, a small, pixelated square on the top of a column in the Metro section. I read the accompanying story, my mug of coffee halfway to my lips. South End resident shot in own home. Boston. Police are investigating the homicide of a Boston resident that occurred in the Worcester Square section of the South End early Friday evening. Police responded to a call for shots fired at 6:22 p.m. According to Boston Police Detective Henry Kimball, the victim, 38-year-old Ted Severson, was found on the second-floor landing of his residence and pronounced dead at the scene. We are also investigating a burglary that occurred on Friday night on the same block as the homicide, Kimball said. We don't know yet if the two crimes are related, but we are asking anyone who might have information to step forward. Ted Severson, president of Severson, Inc., a consulting firm, is survived by his wife, Miranda Severson, née Hobart, who was in Florida at the time of the shooting. According to a neighbor, Joy Robinson, Ted and Miranda Severson were a beautiful young couple. They looked like people you would see on television. I can't believe this happened to them, and in this neighborhood. Anyone with information on either the homicide case or the burglary may call the Boston Police Crime Stoppers line. I set my coffee down, then read the story again. I felt cold all over. It had never occurred to me that, while Ted and I were setting up Miranda to be killed, she might be doing the same thing with Ted. It had to be Miranda, with the help of Brad. There was no way this was a random burglary that had turned into a murder. It was too perfect that Miranda was out of town in Florida with a solid alibi. Brad must have come down from Maine and shot Ted. Maybe he burglarized a nearby house to muddy the waters. Maybe not. Either way, Ted was out of Miranda's way, and all his money would go to her. I thought of Ted. He had been found shot to death on the second-floor landing of his house. He must have let Brad into the house, then made a run for it. He must have known he was about to die, and he must have known that Miranda had engineered it. My throat closed up, and I felt tears well up in my eyes. But they didn't fall. I had grown fond of Ted. When we talked on the plane, I had seen him only as a way to find out more about my college nemesis. Miranda Faith Hobart was a loose thread in my own narrative, and I had told myself that even though she had wronged me by stealing away my boyfriend, I was never convinced that she was a truly poisonous person. But after talking with Ted on the plane and hearing his story of her betrayal, I knew that this was not the case. She was rotten to the core. And maybe I was excited to have a prey again. I will admit that. Killing was a little bit of an itch that I hadn't scratched in many years. But Ted grew on me. More than grew on me, really. When we kissed in the cemetery in Concord, I was surprised by my reaction, by how much I felt from a kiss. I told myself, as I always told myself when getting involved with a man, that falling in love was never an option. I knew I could never go through that again. But I liked Ted a lot. He was handsome and yet somehow awkward, as though he had never really grown accustomed to his good luck. One of those men who own the world but don't quite know it. I could see how Miranda would have appealed to him. Not only was she the sexiest woman in any room, but she was also incredibly comfortable with herself. He must have been attracted to that quality. But besides the intensity of our kiss, the yellow leaves around us, his hand on my sweater, what I really felt with Ted was the unusual sensation of being able to be myself with him, of being able to share secrets with another human being. He was telling me his deepest thoughts, his desire to murder his wife, and one day I told myself I might be able to tell him about my past. But now Ted was gone. And all I could think about was how badly I wanted to see him again, and how that was never going to happen. I went online to see if I could learn anything more about what had transpired on Friday night. There was nothing, just a few newspaper articles that repeated the information from the Globe piece. I thought more about the murder and how Miranda had engineered it. It had to have been Brad that pulled the trigger. There was a possibility that there was a third person involved, but I doubted it. So how did they work? Miranda leaves town and makes sure that Ted will be home alone on that Friday night. Brad drives down from Maine. First, he breaks into a neighbor's house and burgles it. It would have been a neighbor about whom Miranda had information. She would have known the homeowner was away and that he didn't have an alarm system. That would be fairly easy. After the burglary, Brad must have gone to Ted's house and knocked on the door. Ted would have let him in, then all Brad had to do was shoot him. It would look like a burglary gone wrong. Then Brad returns to Maine. I wondered about Brad's alibi. He had to have one. But how could he if he drove from southern Maine to Boston and back and committed two crimes? It would take at least 3 hours, probably more, because he'd need to keep to the speed limits on the highway. Maybe Miranda was counting on the fact that absolutely no one knew about her and her building contractor. But was that a possibility? Ted had found out. Someone else in town must have known. Members of his crew? The bartender at the Kennewick Inn? It didn't seem likely that they'd manage to keep it a total secret. I knew, of course. It put me in a unique position, possessed of all this information from Ted Severson, and no one in the world was aware that we had even known each other. I could go to the police, of course, and tell them everything, without ever mentioning that Ted had also been planning on killing his wife. But I wasn't going to do that. There was a good chance that the police would botch the prosecution and Miranda would go free. And even if she was arrested and convicted, she would become a national celebrity. I could see it already, a woman with her looks who had convinced her lover to murder her husband. It would play out on television for years to come. Miranda deserved punishment. Now, more than ever. I sent a text message to my friend Kathy, telling her that I didn't feel well and canceling our plans to catch an afternoon movie. Then I sent an email to my boss at Winslow College, letting him know that I felt a cold coming on and planned on taking the following day off. My boss was deadly afraid of germs, and always happy to grant sick days. I had work to do, and the first step was to visit Kennewick and meet Brad Daggett. I knew I had to move fast because the police might already be closing in, and I needed to get there ahead of them.
Chapter 17. Miranda. It was just past 10 in the morning, and I could smell the alcohol on his breath. There were dots of sweat along his hairline, and the skin under his eyes was puffy and bruised-looking. "You here alone?" "Yeah," Brad said. We were standing on the gravel driveway of the half-finished house in Maine. It was Sunday. Brad had killed my husband on Friday night, and I knew just looking at him that I'd misjudged his capabilities. He looked feverish, his eyes too bright. "It went okay," I said. "Police think it's a burglary that went wrong, just like we planned."
"Yeah,"
he said again. "How do you feel? You look sick."
"I don't feel so good. It was harder than I thought it would be."
"Baby, I'm sorry," I said. "You won't feel that way for long. I promise. We are going to get married. You're going to be rich. Trust me, this feeling won't last."
"Yeah, I know that."
"Then you've got to pull yourself together. If the police come and talk with you, you can't look like a zombie, okay? It's done now. Ted is dead, and there's no going back." A car slid past on Micmac Road, and Brad turned his head to watch it. I watched Brad. It was a cold morning, and his breath condensed in the air. He turned back to me.
"I don't know if we should be meeting here like this," he said, and pulled a Marlboro Red out of the hard pack in his jacket's front pocket.
He lit it with a match, cupping with both hands, even though there was no wind. "You're my building contractor. My husband was just murdered, and I needed to tell you to suspend work for a few days, just while I figure out what needs to be done. It's no big deal. I'm on my way to see my mother. No one knows about us. No one. You've got to pull it together, Brad."
"I know. I will. It's just that you weren't there." He looked scared.
"Of course he looked scared, baby."
"And there's something else, too."
"What?"
"I think he knew about us."
"What do you mean?"
"He said some things. He said you'd never be with me, and that you were using me."
"He probably just put it together. As soon as he saw you coming through the door with the gun, he figured that you and I were together. There's no way he knew about us before."
"I think he did. It's not like he was surprised. He acted like he'd known all along."
I thought for a moment, wondered if it were possible, but decided it wasn't. "How would he have known?" I said to Brad.
"I don't fucking know, Miranda, but I'm telling you, he knew!"
His voice was pitched high, and his hand with the cigarette bobbed up and down as he spoke. "Shh, it's okay. Maybe he knew about us, but now he's dead, so it doesn't matter, okay?
He could have told someone."
"Who would he tell? I know him. He had no close friends. Maybe he just suspected us, but he wouldn't have told a soul. I promise."
"Okay."
He took a long, gulping drag at his cigarette. "Baby, listen to me. You've got to be prepared with your story. You're a building contractor, and you were working for Ted and me. Ted was never around, but I was. I seemed a little bit bored, had my nose in every detail, but other than that, I was all right. I never hit on you. You never hit on me. Why would you mess up a sweet deal like the one you had? They were filthy rich. You have no idea who might have killed Ted. You have no idea if Ted and I were happy. We seemed happy when you saw us together, but honestly, you weren't paying that much attention. That's it. That's all you know."
"Okay.
Repeat it back to me."
"Jesus, Miranda, I got it."
"Okay. So tell me about your night with Polly. How did that go?"
"Fine. We had lunch at Cooley's, kept drinking, and left around 3. We went back to my place. She was hammered, passed out before I left."
"Did you fuck her?"
"Jesus, Miranda.
I'm not asking for me. I don't care. It's probably best that you fucked her in case she gets asked about the story."
"Why would she get asked? I thought you said..."
"She's not going to get asked, but I'm just making sure. She's your alibi. I want to know what she's going to say on the off chance that the police check your alibi."
"She'll be good. She'll probably say I'm her boyfriend and we did some drinking, then had sex back at my place. She'll say I was there all night. She's not going to say she passed out." I know her. She was still there when you got back? Yeah, she hadn't moved. You woke her up? Yeah, I did just what you said. I woke her up. It was about 10, and I took her back to her car. Another car wound by out on Micmac, and Brad watched it again. He tossed his cigarette, and with his free hand he tugged a little on one of his sideburns. Okay, I said. I'm going to get going. Tell the crew to take a couple days off, okay? Just till I figure out what I'm going to do. I'll call you, but only for work reasons, okay? Yeah, I know. Nothing bad's going to happen, Brad. I promise. I don't think the police are ever even going to talk to you. I know. I stepped forward, glancing toward the road to make sure it was empty, then took Brad's big knuckly hand and guided it down the front of the yoga pants I was wearing. I wasn't wearing any underpants, and on Friday, during the few hours that I was in Miami, I'd gone with my girlfriends to a spa and suffered through a complete Brazilian. I pushed Brad's fingers down far between my legs. "And when this is all over," I whispered, "you and I are going to take a long vacation on some tropical island where no one knows us, and I am going to fuck you blind." "Okay, Jesus," he said, pulling his hand away from me and taking a step back. "Someone will see us." "You worry too much," I said. "That's your problem." "Okay," he said again, and pulled another cigarette from his pack. He glanced back at his truck, probably thinking about the bottle he kept there in the glove compartment. "Gotta go, baby," I said, and got in my car. "Stay cool, okay?" He nodded, and I U-turned out of the driveway. Brad had been a big mistake. That was pretty clear. And all I could do was hope that the police kept their investigation to Boston and never questioned him. I got back onto I-95 and settled in for the long haul to Orono. After marrying Ted, I'd tried to talk my mother into moving closer to Boston, but she'd insisted on staying up in Maine. I gave her some money, and she ended up buying a 1,600-square-foot townhouse that she fell in love with because of a stainless steel fridge and some granite countertops. I told her that owning a nice house in Orono was like owning half a parking spot in Boston, but she still didn't want to move down. I think the reason she wanted to stay in Maine was to rub her newfound money in the faces of her friends. Along with the condo, she also got a new wardrobe and a Mercedes. "Did you tell your father I'm driving a Mercedes now? We had one once, you know, for about 5 minutes," she said to me after she'd bought the car. "Dad doesn't care what you drive, Mom." "You think because he's some kind of intellectual he doesn't care what car someone drives?" "No, he just doesn't care what kind of car you drive, Mom." That had been a few weeks ago. We hadn't spoken again till yesterday, when I called her to let her know that Ted, her son-in-law, had been killed in an attempted burglary. I told her I was coming up for a couple of nights, that I didn't want to stay in Boston. "Of course you don't, Faith." My mother still called me Faith. My middle name, and the name I'd gone by from the age of 6 to the end of college. I'd insisted on changing it when there was another girl with the name of Miranda in my first grade class. When I told my mother I was switching back to Miranda, she'd refused. "I've only just gotten used to it, Faithy, and I'm not turning back." I could tell that Detective Kimball wasn't too pleased when I told him I was driving to Maine to be with my mother. "We could get you a hotel room here in town," he'd said. "Your mother could come down here." "Is it important that I stay in Boston?" "It would be helpful to have you here to answer any questions we might have." Detective Henry Kimball talked in a low voice and seemed far too nervous to have reached any kind of rank in the police department. He had brown hair that was a little too long and brown eyes. He wore a tweedy coat over a pair of jeans. I thought he looked like one of the lost souls who used to work at the literary magazine at college. I wondered how quickly I could make him fall in love with me. Pretty fucking quickly, I thought. "I'm only going to Maine. You have my cell phone number. I can't stay. I can't stay in my house right now. You understand?
Of course, I understand, Mrs. Severson. Completely. Well, then, we'll be in touch. I'll call you immediately if something comes up in the investigation.
We'd had this conversation after I'd identified Ted's body. I took a cab from the police station back to our house and packed a bag. Brad had thought that driving to Maine so soon would look suspicious, but I thought it would look completely natural. After losing my husband, it would make sense that I would want to spend time with my mother. That is, if you didn't happen to know my mother. But driving up to Maine gave me a chance to stop over in Kennewick and check on Brad and find out how much I needed to worry about his nerves. And as it turned out, I definitely needed to worry. Up past Portland, I started losing decent radio stations and slid in one of the mix CDs that Ted had made for me. It began with a song that he claimed was playing at the party where we met, Mansard Roof by Vampire Weekend. I couldn't remember the song from that party, but I liked it and sang along. When I married Ted, I hadn't planned on killing him. I didn't love him, but I liked him enough, and he was generous. He let me spend his money without complaining. Not that he really had anything to complain about. As far as I could tell, the money would never run out. Then, one morning, I woke up in Boston, sun coming through our bedroom window. I looked over at Ted, still deep in sleep, his face pillow-creased. I studied a little patch of dark stubble under his chin that he must have missed while shaving the previous day. He was snoring, lightly, but each ragged breath began with a little nasal hiccup, like his breath had caught on the edge of something. It was infuriating to listen to, and I realized that I was going to spend the rest of my life waking up and looking over at the same face, growing older and older and snoring more and more. That part was bad enough, but I also knew that as soon as Ted woke up, he was going to look over at me, and his face was going to look so pleased, and he would say something like, "Hey there, beautiful." That was the worst. I'd have to smile when all I wanted to do was smash that stupid grin off his face. Ted stirred a little, and I knew he was going to wake up. As quietly as I could, I pulled the duvet off of me and slid my legs over the lip of the bed. I wasn't fast enough, though. Ted woke and ran a finger along my back and said in a sleepy, dopey voice, "Where are you going, sexy?" And right then, I knew I couldn't do it. I wanted the money, but couldn't spend a lifetime with Ted. Not even close. We'd just begun breaking ground on the house in Kennewick. I thought of Brad Daggett, our contractor, and wondered if he might be good for something besides house construction. By the time I reached the outskirts of Bangor, the CD had played through twice, but I kept listening to it. I got off of I-95, drove past the Thomas Hill standpipe, and got onto Kanduskeag Avenue, which took me all the way into town. It was grim, the leaves on the trees having already turned and fallen. Most had been bagged or mulched, and the city had settled back into its familiar color palette of shingle and brick, low dwellings underneath a low gray sky. I got onto State Street, skirting the Penobscot River, heading north toward Orono. A quarter mile from my mother's condo, my phone trilled. I turned down the radio and answered it. "Mrs. Severson, this is Detective Kimball." "Hello," I said, and even though he could be calling about anything, my heart skipped a little. "Sorry to bother you, but we have a question. Do you happen to know what your husband did on the day, on Friday, during the day?" "Far as I know, he was home all day. I saw him in the morning before my flight to Florida. He told me he had work to do, and that night he was planning on eating alone at home. He was going to make lamb. I
texted him to remind him to take it out of the freezer. I made my voice tremble a little. Uh-huh. Did your husband know anyone in Winslow, Mass? I slowed the car down, looking for my mother's townhouse.